black holes on a holiday weekend. The executive is pleasantly surprised to see the large audience. I remind you once again, please don't block the aisles. I guess if you sit quietly over there, it's all right. For those who I hope are hearing me in, will hear our speaker in room number 6, some of the slides will be shown over there immediately following the lecture, and Dr. Unruh will go there to answer some questions. Our speaker this evening is a native of Winnipeg who studied at the University of Manitoba, did graduate work in theoretical physics at Princeton. I just learned a sidelight on his pedigree this evening. His mother taught Eric Vogt in public school, but he does not feel bound by that in any way. Following his PhD, he did research at Birkbeck College in London and at Berkeley. He then held a professorial appointment at McMaster University before moving to the physics department at UBC in 1976. His outstanding research in theoretical physics has been in quantum mechanics and in general relativity, the consequences of Einstein's theory of gravitation. He is known for his expository lectures on these rather exotic subjects. Tonight, he's going to speak to us on an aspect of cosmology that has caught the public fancy, black holes, the edge of the universe. Dr. Bill Unruh.
Thank you. I don't know if I really need this microphone. If you want it shut off, just let me know. My first teaching assignment was to 400 engineering students in a hall of about this size, so I had to learn to speak loudly. Good. Okay. As is evidenced from this audience, willing to come out on a Saturday night, holiday, in fact, as well, to listen to a lecture on the topic, black holes is a subject which seems to have caught the popular imagination. In many ways, physicists have found this strange. Black holes are a rather far-out conclusion of the theory, general relativity, or Einstein's theory of gravity, which even many physicists regard to be rather esoteric. This fascination black holes seem to share with the theory itself, namely general relativity, which created them. In a party book and social etiquette book, which from the 1930s, which I was given by an aunt once, I think trying to improve my social graces, I found as a forfeiture for one of the party games that the hapless player was to describe to the rest of the players what general relativity was. This was considered, I think, an extremely onerous task, as only 2 or 3 people in the world were reputed to really understand general relativity. I also think that my aunt would never have given me the book if she had thought that I would take that one single sentence out of it as seriously as I apparently have. Black holes, however, in contrast to the theory, would seem to be tied also to much deeper levels in the human psyche than was the theory itself. They've gained the reputation as monstrously devouring beasts, threatening doom to all. To link this lecture back to the first lecture, namely Joseph Campbell's lecture on the psychology of C.G. Jung, black holes seem to have become an archetypal image, with the rather explicit sexual imagery contained in the name. Black holes seem to be a symbol of what Jung calls the devouring great mother, of the destructive, annihilating aspects of nature, in which not only life, but the very existence of the material body and all its constituents is destroyed. Now, I think the psychological aspect of black holes would make a fascinating study and would help clarify what the relationship of modern man is to science, and to the impact of science on the modern imagination. As a brief example of this rather negative image black holes have in the popular imagination, I would like to show a slide now, if I can get this right, from, somehow the slides have been disarranged, so you have a brief glimpse of all of them. Ah, there we are. Let me hit the lights. This is a slide taken from the comic strip, Star Wars. And the name of the shadowy figure standing in the background, the Archfiend out to destroy all the forces of good and of life, then his name, of course, is Black Hole. In the course of this talk, I hope I will be able to supplant this rather negative popular image from your minds and show you that black holes are in fact much more attractive, fascinating, and even beautiful objects than the popular imagination would make them. Before I begin, however, I'd like to tell you what I won't be talking about. There's a tendency for some writers to claim that because scientists talk about some seemingly mind-boggling subjects like black holes, therefore the author's own pet, usually rather outlandish musings, must also be correct. Black holes have therefore been linked to ESP, to UFOs, to the Bermuda Triangle, etc. I won't be talking about any of these. Other authors have seen black holes as vehicles for interstellar travel, for intergalactic visits, or talk about matter which collapses, popping out somewhere else as a white hole, whatever that is. All I will say is that one should not confuse the devices which a science fiction writer needs to advance his plot with reality. Finally, I will not accept briefly later on, if I have time, be talking about observations of black holes or the detection of black holes in the universe out there. I'm a theoretical physicist, not an observational astronomer. What I will be describing will be images seen with the eye of the imagination rather than with the real eye. The process of finding any of these objects in the real sky is so fraught with technical problems, with at best circumstantial evidence, with ifs, buts, maybes, etc., that I won't attempt it. Rather, I will try to give you some feeling for the theory, general relativity, which produced black holes. And in particular, I'd like to start off by talking about the alteration which this theory produced in our concept of time. Then I'd like to go on to its explanation of gravity by curvature of space-time. I'll then try to sketch for you how black holes are formed, describe the ultimate fate of the matter that went into forming the black hole, and I'll then try to show you what black holes are like, what they would look like. And finally, I would like to indicate to you why black holes have very recently become of intense interest once again to theoretical physicists. So what I'd like to begin with is time, and to try and give you a sort of a feeling for how black holes altered our concept of time. Now, time is, of course, a concept with which we're all familiar. We're all pretty sure we know what time is. we're all fairly sure we understand what its properties are, except, of course, when we have to try and explain them to someone else. And the other trouble is, however, that your concept of time and mine are probably different. So what I'd like to start off with is to describe for you an experiment which I believe Piaget has described in his attempts to discover how children develop their concept of time. The experiment he talks about is the following. He takes two objects, let us say these two objects, and he has them running on a track or something like this, standing still initially. And at the press of a button, he starts them moving. And at the press of a button, they stop again. And he now asks the child some questions about time in relationship to what he's just seen. For example, did these two objects start at the same time? And the child, yes, of course they started at the same time. Did they stop at the same time? Yes, they certainly stopped at the same time. He then asks them, did either of these objects take more time in traveling? Well, it's an answer, of course, that all adults would know the answer to immediately. And if things start at the same time and stop at the same time, they, of course, travel for the same length of time. The children, unfortunately, don't seem to think that way. They say, no, this object traveled for more time than that object. Now, the problem is that we as adults immediately ascribe this to the child's not understanding us. The child's got some misunderstanding. He's confusing velocity with time, or he's confusing distance with time. I mean, he doesn't really understand it. But what I want you to try and do is to cast yourself a little bit into the role of the child and take it seriously. What I want to try and point out is that what the child is seeing here are essentially two separate concepts of time. The first concept is what I'd like to call a sort of universal time. It's the time in which, or of which, one can say these two objects. So it's a time which applies to all kinds of objects at once. It's not restricted to any one object. These two objects started at the same time, or they stopped at the same time. It seems to be the concept of time that we link with the past, present, and future, which applies to, which is a universal concept of time again. It's not really a concept which is a measurable one. You'll object to that, I know, but we'll leave that. The other concept of time is the one that seems to be measurable for this child, the one he ascribes more or less to. And that seems to be a very specific kind of concept of time. Each of these objects can have a different duration of travel, of motion. Even though they started at the same time, they stopped at the same time, yet there's some sort of duration for this child, for these two objects, that's different. And that's particular to each one of these two objects themselves. Now, as adults, of course, in fact, he discovers that with children by about the age of 12, they've gotten over this notion. In fact, he claims, and I don't know if these experiments have been done again, that between about 8 and 12, they reverse it, and they say that, in fact, the other object took more time than the first, and then finally they get the right time. They get to know what we mean by time, it seems. Now, I'd like you to keep those two in mind. One of the greatest advances in physics that I think occurred with Isaac Newton and actually with the people before him. And one of the main things that he did was to link these two concepts of time. He said there is only one kind of time. There's only this universal concept of time. Individual things don't really have a time associated with them. In fact, it's very interesting if you read the Principia. Wrong one. It's very interesting if you read the Principia, because he starts off by saying that concepts of time and space, everybody knows what they are. We don't really have to spend too much time on them. And he thereupon proceeds to write something like 4 or 5 pages on them, trying to clarify what he means by time. It seems he's arguing too much. Okay, what I'd like to show you, in fact, what he says, if I get this thing right. This is a quote taken from a translation of the Principia. And you notice he defines this true, absolute, true mathematical time of itself existing out there somewhere, flows the same everywhere, without relation to anything external. It's got duration, it's got length, one can measure it. There's also another kind of time which might be associated with bodies, but he doesn't really care about them too much, except insofar as they relate to this absolute, real, true time. Now, in fact, this union of these two concepts of time was probably one of the key things which led to the fantastic outgrowth of physics which followed from the Newtonian laws as he described them. And we couldn't have done without it. But the image that the Newtonian concept of time leaves one with is sort of the image of somewhere back there, behind everything, there's this big clock, God's pocket watch, let's say, which is ticking off the true, real time. It's measuring out what time really is. We may have our own clocks, and our own little clocks are good clocks only insofar as they measure out that time that God happens to be ticking off. Now, I think that this is probably also the kind of concept that you have of time somewhere back in your minds, that there is some one time everywhere at the same time. As you notice, it's difficult talking about time. The revolution that happened with Einstein was that he was forced by physics, by the physical world, and I don't have the time to go into explaining how he was forced to, in fact, go back to this concept that the children seem to have. That there are, in fact, two different kinds of time. That there's an individual time associated with any individual object. That this individual specific time associated with any one object is in fact the time that a clock will measure. A clock measures its own internal time, in a sense. There's another concept of time, and that's this time in which things happen, the time we usually talk about as past, present, and future. This universal concept of time, in fact, in the theory, it tends to be downplayed in Einstein's theories. So let's go over to the specific time, the time as told by clocks. And the way in which he altered the view of what time was that he said that actually what clocks do is not to measure the ticking of God's pocket watch. God's pocket watch doesn't exist. There is no such thing. Then, of course, the question immediately arises, but look, I mean, my clock tells the same time as your clock, tells the same time as his clock. If there's nothing behind them driving it, if there's nothing, no real universal concept of time, how come all our watches seem to tell the same thing? What is that same thing? I'll come back to that. What Einstein said was that, in fact, watches behave very much like the odometer on your car. What does the odometer on your car do? The odometer on your car measures distance, the distance that your car has traveled. But what Einstein set up was a new structure called space-time, It's a thing that's very much like space. Is that readable at all? Of course not. Is that readable? Not much more. Is a structure called space-time, in which time, in the sense, the universal sense, even though that's been downplayed, and space are united into one great whole four-dimensional geometrical structure. He, in a sense, spatialized the concept of time. And he then said, what clocks measure is the distance. Now, this is a four-dimensional distance. It's working in this four-dimensional space-time rather than in space. So what the clocks measure is, in fact, a distance in space-time. This immediately the possibility immediately arises, therefore, that clocks can tell different times. Just as the odometer in your car, you can drive from here to Toronto, and your friend can drive from here to Toronto. You both start at the same place, you end at the same place, but you're not very surprised that your odometers indicate different mileage, because your friend happened to go via Florida and you happened to go straight across on the Trans-Canada Highway. You took different paths, and nobody is very surprised that taking different paths gives different distances. Well, the same thing happens in space-time. The time that a clock shows now depends on the path that you take through space-time. Time becomes an individualized phenomenon. It's individual for every particular thing that you have and depends very much on how you travel. I can now come back to the question that I asked, namely, how come all our clocks tell the same time? Well, that's simply because we were all traveling down the Trans-Canada Highway. I.e., we all travel more or less the same path through space-time. I mean, somebody may take a side trip and stop in at a Howard Johnson's on the way, but that doesn't make very much difference. You can't even measure that on the odometer of the car. And that's why your watches tell the same time, because the trips that you're taking through this structure called space-time are very similar. Okay. Now, unfortunately, I can't continue in this vein, or else I'm never going to get the black holes. So what I want to do now, having introduced the concept of space-time, is to rush forward and to show how Einstein now used this concept of space-time to describe gravity, the force of gravity. Now, Newton, way back when, had described gravity as being a force. The Earth sits there, and by some mysterious means, the Earth pulls everything to itself. He described how that law worked, how the Earth pulls it to itself. He never really said why. And the thing is that there's a very strange feature about gravity, which Newton and, in fact, Galileo already noticed. And that is that gravity seems to be independent of what object it's acting on. Now, most pushes and pulls depend on what's being pulled. For example, the electrical force, if you give a thing a big electrical charge, you can pull on it harder than if you give it a tiny little electrical charge. But gravity doesn't seem to care what the object is. It acts the same way. Now, what I'm referring to is the basic fact that you all probably heard about in physics, that two bodies, no matter what they are, fall in exactly the same way under gravity. They'll both always keep time with each other. And this is a very strange feature of this force. In fact, already in 1908, Einstein described in a paper a rather amazing conclusion. This is the so-called Einstein elevator experiment. And what Einstein did was he said, let's take someone, whoever he is, and stick him in an elevator. Now, I think you're all familiar with hopping into an elevator, especially in one of the real high rises where the elevators get started very rapidly and go up rapidly. When the elevator starts up, you're being accelerated, and you feel heavier. And in fact, everything around you seems to be heavier. Once the elevator goes up smoothly, that doesn't apply anymore. But in the first little instances, everything seems to be heavier. What Einstein pointed out is that, in fact, there would be no way, as long as you stayed in the elevator and didn't peek and look out, there'd be no way that you could tell that someone hadn't, instead of pulling the elevator up the building, hadn't gone ahead and snuck another Earth in under you, a bigger Earth, which pulled on you harder. Now, I mean, you sort of say, well, I'm pretty sure that hasn't happened, so somebody must have pulled me up. But actually, as long as you stayed in that elevator, and as long as you didn't use your common sense, there'd be no way for you to know that somebody hadn't stuck a bigger Earth under you. In other words, as far as the force of gravity on the Earth for us is concerned, we can't tell the difference between gravity and acceleration. So we now come to the problem of trying to explain what gravity is. What is this force of gravity that we feel pulling us to the Earth? Well, actually, we don't feel anything pulling us to the Earth. All we feel is this force under our feet holding us up. Well, the answer is, of course, very simple. The reason we feel this force under our feet pushing us up is not because there's some mysterious force pulling us down towards the middle of the Earth, but it's because the surface of the Earth is accelerating upwards. And that was his explanation of gravity. It really was. Now, I mean, I can sort of feel your mind saying, but I can think of a few objections to that. After all, I have been down in Australia, and Australia is on the other side of the Earth from us, and the force of gravity was the same there. And if the surface of the Earth here in Vancouver is going up, is accelerating up, and the surface of the Earth in Sydney or Perth is going up, the Earth is getting bigger and bigger, right? I know the Earth isn't getting bigger and bigger, so what kind of an explanation of gravity is this? And this is where Einstein, you could say, pulled the rabbit out of the hat and said, aha, but we can get rid of that difficulty by curving space-time. And this is where the curvature of space-time comes in. Now, so far, that's just words to you. So what I'm going to try to do is to give you a feeling as to how the curvature of space-time could, in fact, explain the phenomenon that we see as gravity. To start off with, I better give you a first quick lesson in graphs again. Remind you of your high school physics or wherever else. I always draw crooked lines. What I'm going to draw here is I'm going to try and draw space-time. This thing up here, these directions are supposed to represent time. So time is in some sense supposed to be flowing up the page. Space goes this way. Let us say Vancouver is here, Toronto. I don't know why I always pick Toronto, but there's the lake. Toronto is over there. And in fact, Toronto is over there all the way up this line, because what this line represents is where Toronto is at this particular time, for example, where Toronto is at that particular time. So this is time, and this is space here, and this is basically the simplest representation of space-time. Now, what I want to convince you of is that in space-time, a curved line is acceleration. You start out, for example, in Vancouver, you start out not moving. Well, if you're not moving after a short instant of time, you're still in Vancouver. If you now start moving, Then a short instant of time later, you'll no longer be in Vancouver, you'll be on your way to Toronto, so you'll have moved a little bit. If you now start moving even faster in the next instant of time, you'll have moved a greater distance. And in the next instant of time, an even greater distance. And so if you look where you were at every instant of time, you're going to get a curved line. So the thing about accelerations, when you look at them from the space-time point of view, is that an acceleration can always be seen by a curved line, by having a curved line. Now, I'll just draw for you what I think the basic objection is to having the Earth's surface accelerating as an explanation of gravity. Here's Vancouver, here's Perth, there's the Earth in between. If Vancouver is accelerating, it's got a curved line. If Perth is accelerating, it's got a curved line in the opposite direction, and so the distance, the Earth, is getting bigger and bigger. What I'm going to show you now, by means of one of my Now, this is not a beach ball. This is space-time. Okay. What I want you to do is somehow imagine that, in fact, that's exactly what this is, that this is space-time, that time runs this way, and that this direction here is space. Now, what I've drawn on here is a big black strip. And I think it's fairly, I hope it's fairly evident, barring optical illusions, that this strip is in fact the same width, balloons tend to get away with from one, is the same width all the way up. So that this is supposed to represent the Earth. There's Vancouver, there's Perth. They stay the same distance apart all the time. This balloon is supposed to be curved space-time. And what I want to try and convince you of now is that, in fact, the path that Vancouver is following and the path that Perth is following are, in fact, curved lines, namely accelerated lines in space-time. And the way I've done that is to, on the surface of this balloon, I've taped a couple of pieces of paper. Okay, so there and there. These pieces of paper lie flat against the balloon. They're not supposed to be wrinkled anywhere. If they are wrinkled, that's just experimental difficulties. They're not supposed to be wrinkled anywhere. And if these were straight lines, then when I took them off, you should have a straight strip of paper. In other words, whoever's traveling along this line is headed straight ahead all the time. So what I'm going to do is to take off these two strips of paper and put them on the blackboard for you to see. I'm taking off, I guess that's Perth now, or rather the path that represents Perth and the path that represents Vancouver. And go up to the blackboard if I don't trip. And there's, oh, let's do it this way. I'm laying it flat against the blackboard. And here's the other one. Notice, it's exactly the diagram that I drew here. Namely, Vancouver and Perth are both being accelerated. So it's really true that the reason we feel the force under our feet is not because the Earth is mysteriously pulling us to it, but because the surface of the Earth is in fact accelerating upwards on all sides. And the curvature of space-time is making up for the distance that should have been gained. You'd think that the distance should keep getting bigger, but because space-time is curved, the distance stays the same. Now, this is one of the important things that happens in general relativity, is that the very concept of distance is no longer an invariant. It's no longer something that's always there. It can change. Just like material bodies can change, the very concept of distance can change. Two things can go farther apart without either of them moving, because the distance between them suddenly changes. The other thing I'd like to show you on this balloon incidentally is not an exact representation of the curved space-time around the Earth. I mean, for one thing, time seems to curve all the way back on itself, and we're fairly sure that doesn't happen around us. But what I'd like to show you is that, in fact, many of the phenomena, for example, we throw a ball in the air, it goes in the air, comes back, is also represented on this balloon. Well, what does it mean to throw a ball in the air? You give it some velocity. That means it travels in space and in time. And in fact, on one of these graphs, if that's time, that's space, that's a ball going at a constant velocity. So if it's not accelerated, it's a straight line. Well, the manufacturer of this device, this model, has kindly consented to put on it some straight lines. These lines, in fact, are as straight as one can make them on the surface of the sphere. In the same sense as those are curved, these are straight. Note what happens to a ball that is thrown. It follows a straight line. It goes farther and farther away from the surface of the Earth. Remember, time is going this way, so it's getting farther and farther away from the surface of the Earth. And then it comes back down again and crashes. That's exactly what happens when we throw something in the air. It goes farther and farther away and then comes back down and hits the Earth. So that gravity can be described in terms of this curved space-time. Okay, I hope I've given you, I mean, I obviously haven't given you all the details. Somebody or rather warned me against starting off the lecture by writing down an equation and spending the rest of the lecture solving it. What I'd like to do now is to proceed to talk about how all of this applies to black holes, since after all the title of the talk had something about black holes in it. Okay, what is a black hole and how is a black hole formed? The popular view of the subject, well, probably the right one, is that we have stars out there. Stars are pretty massive objects. The star stays the same size as here. Each particle on its surface must be pushed out, must be being accelerated from Newton's second law. Any acceleration, some force must be acting on it. Now, in the case of the stars, that force is due to the heat of the star. Just as in your gasoline engine, if you heat up the gasoline in your engine, that produces a pressure which drives the piston down. Similarly, in the star, the intense heat produced by nuclear fusion holds the star up against the force, against falling in under gravity. Now, the thing is, as with all fuel, eventually it burns out. In fact, the bigger the star, the sooner it burns out. And what happens once the fuel burns out? The temperature goes down, it can't hold itself up, and it collapses. Now, for a small star, a star the size of our sun, let's say, which is, well, it's about middling size, certainly not very large as stars go, this collapse suddenly becomes very violent. The whole center core of the star collapses in until finally the very nuclei of the atoms touch each other. At this point, the forces between those are enough to hold it up. And the thing, the whole sun, for example, collapses down to an object about 10 miles in diameter. So we've got to imagine the sun all compressed into the size of Vancouver. As you can imagine, this produces a tremendously high density. So one of these things, which is called a neutron star, not a black hole, the density of this thing, one small cube like this, weighs much, much more than all of Mount Seymour does. Now, what happens in one of these collapses is, in fact, that the collapse goes on until finally the nuclei touch each other, and then it just shudders to a stop. And this stopping is an extremely violent process, as most stoppings are. When you drop a body off a tall building and it hits the ground, it's pretty violent. And in fact, what happens is that the very outer layers of the star get blown off in a tremendous explosion called a supernova. And since all talks on black holes and astronomy have to have one of these slides, I've got here, I hope, for you, a slide of the remnants of one of these supernovas, these stars that collapsed down to a core about 10 miles across and blew off its outer remnant. Those are all the remnants left there. This is the so-called Crab Nebula. It's because it's in the constellation of the Crab. Is it? No, that's wrong. It's in the constellation Taurus. And at the center of that, they've discovered a source of very, very steady pulsations. About 33 times a second. And these are almost, this is almost certainly this very dense so-called neutron star sitting there rotating about 10 miles across, rotating at about 33 times a second. And each time it rotates, it sends out one pulse. Okay. Now, if the star happens to be larger than that, in other words, larger than one of the things that formed one of these supernova, if the star happens to be larger than, let's say, about twice the mass of our sun, then in fact this force, even when you press the nuclei of the atoms against each other, they can't hold it up. They can't produce enough acceleration to stop the thing from imploding. And the implosion just carries on. And the result left at the end of that kind of an implosion is what's called a black hole. Now, in fact, the formation of a black hole is probably quite unspectacular. Because in the formation of one of those things, the reason you get this tremendous explosion is because the shuddering stops when the thing forms the neutron star. For a black hole, it never shudders to a stop. The collapse just keeps going. And the outer matter just tends to keep raining in, and not very much happens. So the formation of a black hole is a pretty boring event, usually. Now, what I would like to do is to try and give you a feeling as to what this black hole is and what the curvature of space-time does to try and make a black hole. And I've set up this demonstration, which I hope is going to work. Now, one of the fundamental one of the results of Einstein's theory of general relativity is a phenomenon known as the focusing of light. Now, light, as anything else, travels along straight lines as long as you don't push it. As far as it's concerned, just like something traveling along this balloon, as far as it's concerned, keeps traveling straight ahead in a straight line. But as far as the surrounding people are concerned, let's take the back side of the balloon. Here's something traveling in a straight line, as straight as it can travel on the surface of this balloon. Here's something else. It started off here as diverging. They were going apart. The curvature of space-time, however, causes these things to eventually come back together. It focuses them. So the curvature of space-time can, in fact, focus things that don't have any forces. Over a long range, it can make, in fact, this is what the theory says, is that if you have a lump of matter, that lump of matter alters space-time in such a way that from a global point of view, from a far-off point of view, it seems as though light paths, let's use a different color, light paths are in fact slightly curved. And matter seems to focus light rays. This is one of the most important consequences of Einstein's theory, that the presence of matter curves the space-time, and that curved space-time has the effect of making light beams seem to curve. Okay. What I have here, let me just to make it look proper. You could probably have those side lights on. Oh, okay. Now, I hope you can see that. What these are supposed to be are light rays. That's why this effect. What I have here, what this is supposed to represent, is light rays that have all originated at a point in here. Now, once again, what I'm trying to represent here is space-time. So, this direction here is time. What I'm representing is the paths of certain light rays all originating at one point. So at the initial instant of time, well, let's say the top of this block, the light all has is concentrated in a little circle. A short instant later, it's a bigger circle. A short instant later, it's a still larger circle. Well, we know that's exactly what does happen to light. We pop a flash bulb. The light travels out from that flash bulb like in a big sphere, and that sphere gradually expands at 186,000 miles per second, rather rapidly. So this is supposed to represent the light rays all coming out of a point. Now, this is the point at which I have to try and get you to use your imagination, because I haven't included in this model matter. So each of these light rays, these sets of light rays, in fact, goes past some matter. Now, if there were no matter around, these light rays would simply keep going along straight lines. But with the presence of matter, the light rays get focused. Focusing means that the light rays become more parallel. Well, if I just stick matter in there, that's easy enough to do. The light rays start looking like that. But let's now stick matter all around in a completely symmetric fashion. So we've got matter sitting everywhere. Now this set of light rays is supposed to get focused, but this set of light rays is also supposed to get focused, and soon, I mean, everything starts looking a mess. And besides, we know that this is all nicely and symmetric. Everything is the same all the way around. So I can't just start bending all the light rays in like this. So how can I get focusing of light rays in this situation? The answer is that the focusing happens by the light rays curving up in time. To make it easy for me to curve them all, I've got a little wire hoop here. So what happens is that the presence of matter sitting in here focuses the light rays and they become more parallel. Now, if the light rays happen to pass only a little bit of matter, they're only focused somewhat, and they still keep going out, travel off to infinity. You'll finally see them. But as the star collapses, the light ray goes through more and more matter. They get more and more strongly focused until finally you get the situation where the light rays all started off at that point. They spread out, but the curvature of space-time caused by that matter has been so strong
that the light rays are all focused parallel to each other. The only way you can do that is if they only travel, in a sense, up in time, and they don't spread out at all. So what you have here is a situation in which you have a parcel of light, or an expanding shell of light, that's been focused so much that it can't expand anymore. And so as far as you're concerned, this shell of light just sits there. Now it's light. Light goes as fast as anything can in the universe. So it's traveling outwards as fast as it can. But the best it can do, due to this intense curvature of space-time, is to stay at the same place. Reminds one of Alice in Wonderland very much. Now this surface, where the light rays, where the curvature of space-time has focused all the light rays so that they're all parallel to themselves in time, and you've got this sphere sitting there, which is a sphere of light trying to travel outward as fast as it can, but getting nowhere. That is a black hole. Now, why do we call that a black hole? The reason is simple. Let us say that there's some matter that started off inside these light rays. Can it get out to us? The answer is no. To get out to us, it would have to cross these light rays. In other words, as far as we're concerned, it would have to be traveling in space faster than light does. But nothing can travel faster than light. Light is the fastest thing known to man. And so any matter that happens to be caught in here stays in there. It can never get out. Any foolish person who happens to fall in there, the curvature of space-time never lets him out. To make matters even worse, let's say there was a bit more matter. Let us say that there was even a little bit more matter to focus it even more. Well, if you focus light rays more than parallel, they start coming together. Let's try and illustrate that. It's supposed to be all nice and evenly spaced. Again, experimental difficulties. These light rays now start coming together. And just to illustrate, I couldn't buy 5-foot rods, so I'll do it very strongly. What happens eventually, or in fact, immediately, if there's slightly more matter than enough to curve them parallel to form this black hole, is the light rays all get focused down to a single point. Well, now what happens to any matter that happens to have been in there? Well, it can't go faster than light. This light is traveling outwards as fast as it can and is still going in because of the intense curvature of space-time. And so any matter that happens to be in there is also forced down to a single point. So any object that drops in there, all the dimensions of that object must slowly get compressed until finally a time occurs at which that object has been compressed down to one single point. The density has gone to infinity. At that point, the theory stops. No theory can get through infinity. As far as we know, time stops, space stops, everything stops. So inside a black hole, we've got, in a sense, an edge of the universe, the thing that Columbus feared, or at least Columbus's men feared, going off the edge of the world. And that's what we have, in a sense, in time. One's always forced to this point where one's squeezed down to one single point, if one happens to have fallen into a black hole. Now, there's one great advantage of black holes, and that is that it's not all that easy to fall into them. I told you that neutron stars, and I'll switch off this ultraviolet light. Neutron stars were about 10 miles in diameter. The diameter of this sphere that's traveling, of light that's traveling outward as fast as it can but never gets anywhere. This is called the horizon of a black hole because you can't see beyond it. It's about a mile and a half in radius, 3 miles in diameter. So a black hole, at least a black hole formed from a star the size of our sun, is only about 3 miles in diameter. To even get a black hole that's, let's say, the size of the Earth's orbit, 93 million miles, you would have to stuff in about 50 million stars, collect them all together, convince them all to collapse down to form a black hole. It's not easy because the stars don't all like falling radially in into such a small 93 million mile diameter. So the black holes really are very, very small objects, and as a result, a small object isn't all that hard to miss. It also means that a black hole, for example, is highly unlikely to crash into the Earth. There aren't that many of them around, and they're so small that they'd never get here. Okay, so what I hope I've given you a feeling of is, and again, obviously, I haven't given you all the details, is what happens to matter to form a black hole and what the structure is of space-time, in particular, this sphere of light that's trying to travel as fast as it can but never gets anywhere. Okay. Now, what I would like to do next is that to tell you that we have been extremely fortunate, not that anybody's fallen into a black hole, but that there's been a starship, the Starship Einstein, sister ship to the better known Starship Enterprise, which has recently made a voyage out into the vicinity of one of these black holes, stayed far enough away so it didn't fall in. It's been manned, in fact, by people that you may know. One of them is Lee Palmer from Simon Fraser University. Another one, although he may not realize he went on this trip, is Morris Price. And myself, we made a trip just recently. In fact, the latest voyage came back just this morning to a black hole to see what a black hole looks like. And I'm able to bring back for you the first photographs of what a black hole looks like. Now let me try and tell you what photographs we took, first of all, before I show you the photographs. The black hole was sitting here. It's quite a large one. This one is, in fact, formed of something like 10,000 stars. It's quite a large black hole, so it's about 10,000, 20,000 miles in radius. We were out here about 600,000 miles out, about 15 times the radius of the black hole, with our camera, Polaroid slide camera. The Starship, when you get there, we put the Starship in orbit around the black hole so that we were circling it. Furthermore, this camera, we pointed our camera starting off, just to increase the suspense, we started off by pointing the camera away from the black hole, and we kept it pointed in that direction as we traveled around the black hole. Now, what this is going to look like, of course, is that as we come around the black hole, we'll always see the same stars out there, but gradually it will look as though the black hole is moving into that star field. As we come down here, we'll see the black hole having moved into that star field and then moves back out again. Now, unfortunately, our movie camera, as movie cameras are wont to do, didn't work. But our slide camera did work. And so what I would like to show you first is our best four slides, and then another series of slides to give you another feeling of what it looks like around the black hole. So if I can get everything set up right here, which one am I on? That one? Lights. It may help to have those off now, if I could just... Let's see if I can get this to work. Okay, so let's kill this. All right. We happen to have pointed it at that familiar constellation, the constellation of Orion. Now, of course, I can't see anything. Oh, thank you. There's the constellation of Orion, the three belt stars, the sword star. There's the brightest star in the heavens, the dog star Sirius. There's the constellation Taurus, the Pleiades, etc. So this is the constellation that we pointed our camera at as we went around the black hole. Now, the next slide came when we were a quarter of the way around in the circle. Again, not that terribly much has happened, except the movie camera refuses to focus it. So not that much has happened. Of interest to those of you who are physicists, at this point, we're traveling away from the constellation, and there's an effect called aberration, which in fact makes Orion look larger when we're traveling away from it than it did in the first instance. Let's show you the first slide again, I hope. There it is in the first slide, and there we catch it for a brief glimpse in the second slide. Now, the third slide, the black hole will have moved into the star field. And so here we are, the first known picture of a black hole. There comes the focus. That is a black hole. Orion is still in there, or rather the stars are. Inside here, with this very faint nebula surrounding it, all of these stars out here. Orion, well, I can't point it out to you, it's been so distorted. There is the constellation of Taurus, which has also been distorted, the Pleiades, etc. Now, the important point about this slide is that you may think that all that faint nebulosity around the black hole is matter falling in, maybe, or some light being given off by the black hole or something. It's not. As I mentioned to you before, the presence of the black hole, the presence of matter, curves light, bends the path of a light ray. Where are we? So here is the black hole, let us say. Here is a star, and let us say here we are. The star is way far off there, actually. The light from the star travels by and gets bent by the black hole. So the first thing you notice, I better get out of the way. The first thing you notice is that the apparent position of the star is slightly away from the black hole from where it would be if the black hole wasn't there, due to the bending of light around the star. But because of the intense curvature of the space-time, one can get even more drastic curving of light. Namely, the light from that star can pass fairly close to the black hole and come at us this way. So what we see is another image of that same star once again here near the black hole. I can't even see it now. I'm blinded. Those faint stars, in fact, all of these stars out to here, are all second images of other stars that exist in the universe around you. I think I can't ever really place these. Ah, yes. The easiest one, there's the constellation Taurus, a bright star there, a little triangle. Down here on the other side of the black hole, you see that bright star? That's the second image of that bright star. Then there's a little triangle there. There's the next star there, the next one there, the next star of the triangle. The fourth one is the fifth one is washed out by the bright star. So there, in fact, is the second image of that constellation there. Similarly, each of these stars, I think these stars, I can't, Orion is somewhere in here in this mess as well, but by this time Orion has become so distorted I can never find it. So I won't even try. So there you have the first slide, as far as I know, in existence in the world of what a black hole would look like if you were in orbit around it. Now, just to give you a feeling of how the stars move, it's a very crude feeling, but I hope it'll give you some feeling of how these stars move as the black hole moves into the field of view. We, in fact, on this voyage around, took a series of 36 slides pointing always in the same direction out towards Orion. And in this series of slides, you'll be able to see the black hole moving into place, see Orion, especially Orion, tremendously distorting, see the image of Orion on the other side of the black hole, the second image also distorting, and then finally coming back together again. So I'm going to run through that slide sequence now if everything goes right. Oh, just to show you, let's give you the last slide here. There it is, Orion again. We've gone three-quarters of the way around the orbit, and the star field has recollected. Now, again, the aberration effect for the physicist has made this image smaller because we're traveling towards it. Okay, let me go through this star sequence, this other slide sequence that I have here, and hope that everything works. Now, this one, in fact, the camera was slight. We didn't get the exposure right, which I hope is a bit forgivable. When you're this close to a black hole, one gets a little bit nervous and doesn't quite get the exposures right all the time. And what we're going to do is do a sequence of slides as we travel around this black hole. Now, unfortunately, they are very dim, so I hope you'll be able to see them. Let's switch that off. Yes, let's get the right button here before we switch everything. Yes, okay, good. Now, there's Orion. There's one of the bright stars. I was taught the names this morning and I promptly forgot them. There are the three belt stars, quite faint. There are the other two stars in the hourglass. And there's the sword star. There's the dog star, Cirrus again. Up there, almost completely invisible, is Taurus somewhere. Okay, so as your eyes become dark adapted, you will, I hope, be able to see Orion better as time goes on. So let us go through this voyage around the black hole. The stars are gradually shifting position, you notice, due to a number of effects, including misalignment of the slide projectors. Again, a lot of this movement now is because before one was traveling parallel to the image that one's looking at, and now one's starting to travel away. I hope you can see Orion. Notice Orion is beginning to distort on this, on its left-hand side. The top stars are beginning to move up and the bottom stars down. The distortion is rather severe by this point. It's rather thin and elongated. Sirius is really moving down. Notice that last jump there. Now the black hole is going to move in. The dim stars you saw on that slide, which is quite accurate. The exposure was too dim for all the rest of the stars, but somehow we managed to get the exposure the other way around. We overexposed the stars around the black hole, so the black hole is going to appear much brighter than it did to us. And here comes the black hole moving into the field of view. Orion is tremendously distorted. You can see about all you can see of it by now are the three belt stars there. One of the stars has moved all the way up to there. The other star is down here. The next slide, you won't be able to see Orion essentially at all. In fact, all of these stars, most of these stars are one or the other of the belt stars or one or the other of the stars of Orion. And this, for example, is the image of this star. This is the second image of this star. You can't see the second image of this. This is the second image of this star. Now the black hole moves through, and Orion begins to reassemble itself on the other side. There's the sword star, the bright star at the bottom, the top star. Now on this slide, I hope you can see it. I don't know if you can. I can hardly. Here's Orion become reassembled. Just on this side, there's the three belt stars of Orion there, the two top stars of Orion badly skewed over there, and the bottom two stars there. Again, the second image of the stars in Orion. The black hole moves through the field of view. Orion reassembles itself. Incidentally, to give you a feeling of what the size of this is, this picture was taken in such a way that to properly view the star field, one should be standing closer to the screen than I am, levitated up so that one's eyes were level with the screen. So in fact, you're looking at a very large section of the sky in this picture. Anyway, the black hole keeps moving out. It's just disappeared off the edge of the picture there. Orion has reassembled itself. And we're almost at the end. I hope. Well, let's say we're at the end. So that gives you an idea of what a black hole would look like. Now, I don't know about you, what your image was always of what a black hole was. I think it usually is this sort of image of this black thing sitting there occulting all the stars, threatening to eat everything up. For me, I find this image of the nebula this nebular black hole, all the stars of the universe clustering tightly around the black hole, sort of showing off the glory of the black hole. A much more glorious image than the one that's usually given. Okay, let's see what the... Oh, dear. time. I've been moving much faster up here, so my time has, of course, gone much slower, and I've only been lecturing for 40 minutes yet, according to my time. Well, as I said, I could have talked about observations. As I think you can appreciate, observations are difficult. If this thing is 1 mile across, even with that nebula, if this thing is only 1 mile across and the nearest one is some millions and millions of miles away from us, it's a little hard to see. So the only way one can think of seeing them is through very circumstantial evidence. In particular, one way one might hope of seeing them is by means of matter falling into them. And I have here the photograph of a black hole. And what this is supposed to represent, this was a photograph taken from a journal. I've lost my pointer again. And this gas, this blood particular, but these aren't stars, those are just defects in the photograph. This is the black hole in there, and this is a gas disk, a very thin disk, swirling around the black hole. We're looking at this disk from about this angle. We've got the black hole sitting here, and the disk is all around the black hole flat. Now, the reason it seems to bump up in the back is, again, because of this focusing. We're looking over the black hole. The light is bending up to us over the top of the black hole. Inside there, you can see a very, very thin ring. Now, what that is the image of the underside of this side of the black hole bending around the black hole and coming back out at us. So, in fact, seeing the underside of this part of the gas disk. Now, the thing is, when matter falls into a black hole is like a tiny drain plug in a bathtub. The matter can't just fall in, it starts swirling around. And this is a huge swirl of matter. The matter, in fact, is swirling this way around the black hole. As it gets nearer, it gets heated up, producing tremendously high temperatures and glowing. This part of it seems hotter than that because in this part, the matter is coming towards us and throwing the light at us. On that side, the light is being thrown away, and so it's rather darker. Now, because of the glow of these kinds of emission regions around black holes, you'd expect these regions to give off things like X-rays and so forth. And by looking for these X-rays and being able to discount any other possible source, of which there are a number, of these X-rays, one can get a glimpse that maybe there's a black hole there. But as you appreciate, it's rather circumstantial evidence. You can't really say it's there. Now, just before I come to my conclusion, I'd just like to give a slide to answer all of you, to answer the question of those people like the National Science and Research Council who keep asking, what are the practical applications of your research? So without comment, I will show the next slide taken from Analog Magazine. I tried to order one, but for some reason they didn't put their address on it. All right, having paid my dues to the world of applicability, I would finally like to return once again to the world of the imagination. And I'd like to talk a little bit again about the symbolic aspects of black holes that I mentioned very briefly at the beginning. It's a rather strange occurrence. In Jung's description of the world of the archetypes, He notes that there is no image. Oh, I've got lights here, yes. That there is no image of utter destruction and annihilation in the human psyche that ever remains constantly as such. Such images arise very often in times of personal individual crises, but the destructive image almost always changes to become one, to become an image of the bringer of a new creation, of a reconciliation of the crisis, and brings forth a new unity within the psyche of the individual. Now, what I'd like to describe right now is how exactly such a process has occurred with black holes. It's strange, I mean, it's strange even to me. I've been interested in Jung as well as physics for a long time, but one doesn't tend to connect things one's interested in usually. And it's even strange to me because physics would seem to be a field of study which is the farthest removed from psychology, from the play of archetypes, etc. But maybe since physics is also a product of the creative imagination of man, it's not too surprising that maybe archetypes can arise there as well. The reason I've put in this preamble is that theoretical physics today suffers from exactly such a crisis, such a split. And it's of the deepest sort. There have been two theories in the 20th century, the theory of general relativity, which we've talked about today, and there's the other thing called quantum theory. Now, general relativity describes gravity, describes it very well as far as we know. Quantum theory describes matter. Now, matter and gravity are linked, and yet the two theories are, in fact, it seems philosophically incompatible with each other. It seems as though physics has almost gone a little bit schizophrenic and used one thing to describe one aspect of reality, another image to describe the other aspect of reality, and the two don't fit together. Now, one of the prime regions in which this occurs is in the region of time that we talked about earlier. I can't talk about what happens with time in quantum mechanics, but there's a sense in which the other aspect of time, I mentioned, remember, that in relativity, it's this sort of individual aspect of time. Clocks measure their distance along their path. Individual times differ. And the other time, the sort of universal concept of time, usually called coordinate time in general relativity, is downplayed. In fact, every course in general relativity starts off with a lecturer getting up there, as I have just done this last week, telling his students that coordinates are completely irrelevant to physics. The real physics doesn't care about coordinates. And in a sense, what's happened is that this one aspect of time has been thrown away. In quantum mechanics, it's exactly that aspect of time that becomes of importance in describing physical reality. Quantum mechanics talks about probabilities, and the probabilities are only realized by observations of people. There is a real sense of past, present, and future in quantum mechanics that there isn't in general relativity. So there's this sort of a split, a schizophrenia in physics right now, which over the last 50 years, physicists have tried and tried and tried to get rid of this split. And every time they do it, the mathematics nicely hands them back something like infinity. Well, infinity is just nonsense as far as mathematics is concerned. One's never been able to achieve this. This kind of a unification. Okay, now this is where black holes come into the picture. One hasn't been able to achieve a unification, but recently, within the last 5 years, the work of a British physicist by the name of Stephen Hawking and a number of other people around the world they began trying to apply quantum mechanics to one of these black holes. It's purely a theoretical speculation. There's no way one could measure this as far as is known at present. They tried applying these two theories, trying to bring the two theories together, and an amazing thing happened. What they discovered when they tried these very naive attempts at unifying the two theories was, in fact, a larger unification of physics came out of it. What was discovered was that black holes are not these dark, all-absorbing entities. Black holes, in fact, not only can absorb matter, but also emit matter. Now, that emitted matter is not coming from inside it, but somehow the space-time just outside the black hole is unstable. And the black hole.